this point would surprise me much. Again, fair point. I'm willing to listen if you want to tell me why you're really planning to leave End. Marsh stayed silent, staring at Granny. That's fine, Granny said after a minute. If your father doesn't move quickly enough, we'll be torturing you a bit to motivate him, a video and all of that. While we're doing that, I'll have them ask you about this again. Torture doesn't get truthful answers. That's what they say. Again, we'll see. Granny stood up and pointed to the far end of the container. In the meantime, there's a toilet in that far corner, and over here there's a cooler with water and a few snacks. He pointed toward the near end. The door is here. If you get within 5 feet of it, an electric current goes through it. If you touch it, you probably won't die, but you'll wish you had. If you still somehow manage to open it anyway, my people on the other side will make you wish you hadn't. You understand? Marsh nodded. Good. Granny considered Marsh. I do apologize about this. This wasn't how I would have done it. And I realize this will make things awkward between us from here on out. For starters, Marsh said, echoing Granny's comments from earlier. Granny smiled and exited. Marsh went to the cooler, took out a bottle of water and drank from it, looking at his surroundings again. Table lamp, chairs, toilet, cooler, no cot. A cold metal floor and cold metal walls. He walked to the front of the room, not too close to the wide doors, and heard voices on the other side, low, masculine. He couldn't make out what they were saying. This is lovely, he thought. The only good news in any of this was that Granny gave back his data crypt, which was rather more valuable than he knew. Otherwise, this was a mess. By now, his father would probably have been contacted by Granny Nohamapeton. Marsh didn't know how his father would react. On one hand, this was exactly the sort of thing he'd push back against. On the other hand, Granny was right that the only things Dad really cared about in this life were his children. There was also the matter that somewhere between a week and a month from now, interdependency marks were going to be worth less, pound for pound, than dirt. That being the case, Dad might hand the money over simply because it wouldn't matter in the long run, or even the slightly longer than short run. But then this uprising, which was beginning to look like it might sort itself out, and not in the Duke's favor, might get a new burst of life from those additional weapons. More death, more destruction, more people displaced from their homes, at a time when everyone on End's life was going to be turned upside down anyway, because of the flow stream out from the planet closing up. Marsh took another swallow from his water. He was afraid and deeply concerned for his individual well-being. Granny Nohamapeton struck him as just the sort of smug sociopath that would in fact have him tortured just for fun. But he also felt strangely detached. Whether that was shock at his current state of being, or just awareness that human civilization was close to the end, so relatively speaking this was nothing, or both, was something he couldn't parse. He was scared, but he was also tired. At the moment, at least, being tired was something he could actually do something about. So Marsh Claremont went back to his chair, sat in it, put his feet up on the table, crossed his arms, closed his eyes, and tried to take a nap. Some indefinite time later, he felt himself being shaken awake. "Look who's here to see you," said a familiar voice. Marsh opened his eyes, blinking, and tried to focus on the thing directly in front of him. It was Jiggy, his stuffed pig. The person behind Jiggy, waving him in Marsh's face, was his sister Vrenna. "You found me," Marsh said, groggy. "That's what I do," Vrenna replied, handing Jiggy over to her brother. "Why weren't you electrified?" "What?" Vrenna looked puzzled. "Never mind. How did you find me?" "I had help. I'll explain later. Are you okay to walk?" "I'm fine." "Then let's get moving before the two chunks I stunned wake up." Vrenna led Marsh out of the room, which was, as suspected, a repurposed cargo container, located inside a tumble-down warehouse. Mars's container was not the only one. Two more, presumably currently unoccupied, were lined up next to his. One of them had a long streak of blood curving away from it, as if a body had been dragged away. Outside Mars's container, two men lay on the floor of the warehouse, the same two who had grabbed him and pulled him into the van. They were breathing, which was more than Mars really wanted for them at the moment. "What is this place?"
"It looks like an extracurricular detention center," Vrenna said.
"For the Duke?"
"Maybe. Come on."
Vrenna led her brother out of the warehouse and pushed him toward a nondescript ground car. Mars got in and buckled up while Vrenna put the thing into manual drive.
"Where are the others?" Mars asked, looking around.
"What others?" Vrenna asked.
"You came to get me alone?"
"I didn't have a lot of time to make a project out of it."
Vrenna checked her surroundings and began driving off.
"What if I'd been injured? What if I hadn't been able to walk? What if there had been more than two of them?"
"I would have figured something out.
I have notes on this rescue.
I can put you back if you like." Mars giggled and clutched his stuffed pig tighter. "Don't mind me, sis," he said. "I'm just having a little post-kidnapping freakout." Vrenna reached over and took her brother's hand.
"I know," she said.
"Go ahead and freak out a little. I don't mind." After a couple of minutes of relatively restrained freakout, Mars held up Jiggy and looked at him.
"You brought Jiggy with you."
"I did. I thought it might distract you from thinking too much while I got you out of there."
"It worked, but I'm wondering how you got him in the first place."
"He was given to me, along with the rest of the stuff you had in a rucksack when you were kidnapped."
"Okay, but how did you get any of that?"
"It was given to me by the people who were watching you."
"People were watching me?"
"Yes."
"Who?"
Chapter 8. The call from Granny Nohama Peaton after he lost Mars Claremont had to be one of the most satisfying calls Kiva had ever gotten in her life.
"Mars Claremont is gone," he said.
"Who?"
Kiva replied.
"Don't fuck with me, Kiva. I want to know where he is."
"I couldn't tell you where he is. It's not my job to keep track of him. My job, as I understood it, was to tell you if he tried to book passage on my ship. He did, and I told you. You were supposed to wait until he was about to board to snatch him, if I remember correctly. You decided not to wait. So it looks like this one is on you."
"The people I had with Claremont tell me they were attacked by a woman."
"It wasn't me.
It was Vrenna Claremont."
"You mean the sister who had years of training to murder people for the state and then became a cop?"
"Yes, that would be my logical guess, too."
"I want to know how she came to find out we were targeting her brother."
"So ask her."
"Kiva."
"I didn't tell her, if that's what you were asking."
"Why would I tell her? I had 3 million marks riding on you snatching him."
"Someone in your crew told them."
"Or, and here's just a theory, when you tried to extort the Count of Claremont in front of his adult children and you didn't immediately get what you wanted, maybe they figured an asshole like you would try to force his hand with something like kidnapping. So they made preparations, particularly the one of them who was a fucking soldier and is now a goddamned cop, Granny."
There was silence on the other end of the call for a moment. Then,
"I'd like to know how you heard about that."
"Because Mars Claremont fucking told us," Kiva said. "He told my chief purser about it when he was booking passage, and then my purser told me, because his job is to tell me things that will affect my ship's bottom line. Are you really such a smug asshole that you didn't think the Claremont kids wouldn't talk about that? If there wasn't a fucking war going on, and the rule of law wasn't basically suspended while the Duke thrashes about for a few more days before the end, your ass would already be in jail for extortion, with the Duke letting you be the fall guy. For fuck's sake, Granny, you tried to extort an imperial official in front of a fucking cop. You have to be spectacularly dense to try to pull a stunt like that."
There was another silence, and Kiva merrily counted off the seconds before Granny spoke again. She got to 6.
Have you heard from Mars or Vrenna Claremont?
Kiva snorted.
Why the fuck would I hear from them? I'm not the one they were dealing with. It's doubtful they have the first clue who I am. If they were going to contact anyone, it would be my chief purser. And before you ask, they haven't contacted him since you pulled your stupid stunt. If I were going to guess, I'd suspect they're probably trying to book passage on another ship leaving End.
Which ones are leaving in the same time frame as yours?
Do I look like a fucking traffic controller to you, Granny? I don't know, and I don't really care.
I'd like you to delay your departure.
Why would I do that? Even if I wanted to, which I don't, our spot at Imperial Station is already scheduled to be taken over by another ship. We've got nowhere to stay.
Your ship could stay within system.
Or we could leave when we're supposed to, because we've got a fucking schedule and you don't make it.
I would owe you a favor, Granny said.
Kiva laughed out loud at this. Then, say that again, Granny. I want to see if I'll laugh as much a second time.
We used to be friends.
We used to fuck each other. It's not the same thing, which you, of all people, know.
More silence. Then, I'd like to talk about the 3 million marks.
I'm sure you would.
I don't have Claremont. I'm not sure why you should have my 3 million marks.
I should have them because the deal was I let you know if he booked passage. He did. The rest was up to you. It's not my fault you hire incompetence.
Kiva, if I find out that you were behind him escaping, you won't like it.
Well, I have two responses to that. One, fuck you, you shitty little example of a human. Two, if I were behind it, what the fuck could you do to me? I'm leaving End, you asshole. I'll be back home within a year, and I'll be taking a job at corporate. I've done my time on a ship. You, meanwhile, will still be here, a pimple on the ass end of space. So, threaten all you want, you amoral fuck. It doesn't mean anything.
Granny sighed. Kiva, despite everything, I still like you a little bit.
I'm touched, Granny. Really, I am.
This is why I'm telling you now, that you have no idea what's coming, and why, in the end, it wouldn't be a bad thing to stay on my good side.
I'm perfectly happy to stay on your good side, Granny. What I'm not perfectly happy to do is give you back 3 fucking million marks because you didn't think through the terms of the deal. Or to pretend to be intimidated by you huffing and puffing at me about how you'll make me regret crossing you. Grow the fuck up, Granny.
I'd like you to tell me if the Claremonts contact you. And by you, I mean any member of your crew.
I'll be happy to do that for another 500,000 marks.
Kiva?
Kiva? What, Granny? We're doing business here.
You want information. You were willing to pay for that information before. I'm letting you have more information, at a substantial discount from before. You know I'll still have people at Imperial Station looking for him to board your ship.
Of course. I would too in your shoes. But I don't think you're going to find him. If he has any brains at all, he'll find someone else to get him off this fucking rock. Which, I will note, is fine with me. I already have his 500,000 marks for passage, non-refundable, which, I will note, was the amount that finally pushed this whole fucking shitbag of a trip into the black.
Well, that and your 3 million marks.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Where are you now? On the station or on the planet?
I'm on the planet, having meetings with our people here before we head out. Tell your fucking Duke we'll expect our money back with interest. That is, if he manages to keep his head for the next week, which I'm officially doubting, and which would not bother me at all.
Would you like to have dinner?
What?
Kiva said. Would you like to have dinner before you go?
You know of a restaurant that's open during a civil war?
We could have it at my place.
Kiva laughed. You're actually, literally, still trying to fuck me.
I'm not going to lie. I wouldn't mind. We did it pretty well before everything.
Yes, we did,
Kiva admitted. The actual fucking was good, Granny. It's the metaphorical fucking I'm not in the mood to forgive, now or ever.
Fair enough. Let me know if the Claremonts contact you. You know the fee. Fine.
Good doing business with you, Granny. Granny snorted and broke the connection.
You know that he would have tried to kill you if you went to dinner with him, Vrenna Claremont said.
She and Mars were sitting with Kiva in a conference room at the House of Lagos's local offices.
I would have broken his goddamn spine, Kiva said.
Vrenna smiled at this.
I'd like to go back to the part where you told Granny Nohama Peaton that I booked passage from you, Mars said.
What about it?
You told him?
You already know I did.
Why?
Because I needed the 3 million marks he offered for the information.
Yeah, but then he grabbed me and held me hostage and planned to torture and maybe kill me.
Kiva shrugged.
We told your sister immediately after they grabbed you because I had people watching you. And then we gave her all the information she needed to find you and get you.
Hell, we even gave her your rucksack with the adorable little stuffed pig in it as proof we weren't fucking around.
I still could have been hurt, or I could have died.
You weren't and didn't, but
Kiva held up a hand.
Can I just wrap up this whole line of conversation by saying I really don't give a shit whether you're upset? If you were actually hurt or dead, then I'd say sorry. But you're not, so suck it up. The way I see it, if Granny wanted you bad enough to give me 3 million fucking marks for you, then sooner or later he would have just tried to grab you anyway, whether or not I told him anything. Since that was the case, I decided to get paid. The strip was in the red, now it's not.
And we did give your sister information to save your ass. Stop whining about it, for fuck's sake.
I literally don't know what to say to that, Mars said.
You could say thank you, Kiva said, and noticed Vrenna smiling.
I don't think I will, Mars said.
Okay, but either way, let's table this and move on, shall we?
Mars lapsed into silence, next to his still-grinning sister, and Kiva noted that both of them were attractive. Mars, in a nerdy, probably attentive and considerate way, and Vrenna, in a way that suggested that it was 50-50 whether your bed frame would be a pile of kindling at the end of a fuck date. Whether Kiva had wanted to admit it or not, Granny's totally insincere attempt at a rendezvous had reminded her it had been a week since her last attempt at an orgasm with that assistant purser, and in the time since, she was either too busy or too pissed off even to rock herself off. This qualified as an absolute fucking tragedy, no pun intended, which Kiva would need to attend to one way or another. She idly wondered whether either of the Claremont twins would be the sort to assist her in this regard. She decided that Mars probably wouldn't, at least not at the moment. He still seemed put out at the idea that Kiva was fine letting him be snatched for 3 million marks, and honestly, that was totally fair. But maybe Vrenna might. Kiva regretted that time, necessity, and circumstances made following up on that an impossibility.
Lady Kiva?
Vrenna prompted.
I'm sorry, Kiva said. I got distracted thinking about sex.
Vrenna smiled.
We still have the problem of getting Mars onto your ship, she said. Granny Nohama Peaton still plans to have people on hand at Imperial Station in order to grab him.
Granny is looking at the front door, Kiva said. He's not looking at the servant's entrance.
What does that mean? Mars asked.
Kiva looked at him. That means you're not coming on to the yes, sir, as Mars Claremont. You're coming on as Christian Jansen, crew member.
How am I going to do that?
I imagine that when you booked passage, Gazan Magnoot tried to sell you some forged travel documents.
He did. I didn't need to get them.
Well, now you do. More accurately, they've been gotten for you.
For which you'll no doubt charge me, Mars said.
I'm charging you at cost, not the ridiculous fucking markup we're charging everyone else.
Travel documents aren't going to be enough, Vrenna said. Crew on trade ships have to have biometrics as well.
With all due respect, if Nohama Peaton is willing to pay 3 million marks to get Mars, he's going to be checking the servant entrance as well, and that includes getting into Imperial Station's biometric database.
You act like this is our first time smuggling someone on as a crew member, Kiva said.
She turned back to Mars.
Shave your head. You're getting a dermal wig with cultivated hair, scalp and beard. If anyone plucks a hair out of your head, the DNA would match Christian, not you. You'll get contacts to fake iris and retinal patterns, and you'll get a thumb pad with the correct thumbprint and DNA. We'll put lifts in your shoes. You won't look like you. Unless they take a blood sample, you'll be fine.
And if they take a blood sample? Mars asked.
Well, then I guess you're fucked, aren't you? But they don't do that.
No one will notice you've manufactured a human out of thin air, Vrenna said.
Christian has worked for us before, Kiva said. We have one or two of these for every system we work. So does every other house.
Why? Mars asked.
Because sometimes someone important fucks up and has to leave town in a hurry before someone like her, Kiva jerked a thumb at Vrenna, catches up with them and sends them into a hole. It's entirely possible Grenny will be using one of these himself soon at the rate he's going.
So I'll have to be Christian this entire trip.
That'll be your name, yes. Once we get into the flow, you can ditch the fake parts. We'll update you in the system. One catch. You're going to have to be an actual crew member the entire trip.
Why does he have to do that? Vrenna asked.
Because Christian is taking the place of an actual crew member. You take up crew space, you take up crew responsibilities. That's the deal.
I don't suppose I'll get paid.
Sure you'll get paid. Standard rates. Not that you'll be able to spend them anywhere. It's a straight shot to Hub.
And a refund on the passage fee we gave you?
Don't be stupid. Mars smiled. Just checking. And I'll be charging you for the new identity, too, by the way. Also at cost, not cheap.
How do we get out of here now? Vrenna asked.
You know Nahama Peyton will have people watching this building if he doesn't have them doing that already.
Neither of you leaves yet, Kiva pointed to Mars.
He stays here and will bring in our people to work on him. Then he can walk out as Christian. She pointed at Vrenna.
You'll have to wait until we're gone. Sorry.
Vrenna shrugged.
It's not the worst place I've been holed up.
Kiva nodded and then stood up.
I'm heading back to the ship.
She nodded to Vrenna.
I'll never see you again, which I figure is a tragedy.
Vrenna smiled at this.
Kiva turned her attention to Mars.
You, I'll see on the ship, but we won't exactly be socializing. So, nice to meet you, welcome to the Yes Sir, and thank you for allowing me to screw Grenny Nahama Peyton one more time before I never have to fucking see him again.
Mars smiled and nodded, and then Kiva was out of the conference room. Her local staff had already been briefed on what to do with the Claremont siblings, and were warned that if their identity or location were leaked to anyone, that the House of Lagos would make it a priority to fuck with the lives of everyone in their family for 6 generations at least. She was reasonably confident that no one would talk. As she got into her fortified ground car to head back to port, taking a circuitous route to avoid the neighborhoods where the fighting was still going on, or that had been reduced to rubble, Kiva reflected on 2 things. The first was that the Civil War on End both took and gave away. It fucked her and the House of Lagos with regard to the Haverfruit and their monopolies, but sent enough rich people scurrying her way that her trip ended up making a profit. When that profit was added to the licensing and other fees that would eventually be recouped here on End, the House of Lagos would be in a very good position with regard to other houses and its ability to exercise power among them. Kiva had pulled out a save, and that was something she could use at home. The second was that while she let the Claremont twins listen along to her conversation with Grenny Nahama Peyton, they didn't know one important piece of information that Kiva did. Discovered through the graces of the investigators that Magnoot paid a frankly rapacious amount of money to in order to discover. The Duke of End never told Grenny Nahama Peyton to ask the Count of Claremont to release Imperial funds, and he certainly never authorized Grenny to fucking kidnap one of the Count's children and hold him for ransom. He did both of those things on his own. What the fuck are you up to, Grenny? Kiva asked herself as her ground car lumbered off to port. What are you planning? And while we're at it, what is the rest of your fucking family planning too?
Chapter 9. The forensics from the scene are confused, Your Majesty, said Imperial Guardhead Sir Hybert Limbar. The guard was responsible for the Emperor's security. Sir Hybert was pretty sure that he would soon be out of a job. Some witnesses said they saw something launch from the crowd outside the cathedral and strike the balcony, but there is no conclusive video of that. Even if there was something launched from the crowd, the balcony is intentionally designed to withstand anything short of an artillery attack. We figured whatever was exploded there was planted there sometime before. But we don't know. It will be a bit of time before we have it sorted out.
Cardinia nodded. She was in her private apartments at the palace, ears still ringing, and on a medical watch due to concussion, but otherwise unharmed. At least physically. Where her heart was, there was a Nafa-shaped hole. She was attended by Limbar, by Archbishop Corbine, and by Gel Deng, who was at least temporarily acting in the role Nafa held. Also in the room, Amit Nohama Peten, for reasons Cardinia did not understand yet, but assumed she would soon learn.
Reports are additionally complicated by the bombs that went off in the crowd near simultaneous to the explosion on the balcony. It added chaos to an already chaotic scene. Limbar concluded.
How many dead in the crowd? Cardinia asked.
Ma'am, you shouldn't worry about that right now.
Why not?
Cardinia said, and slipped into Imperial mode, which gave her just enough emotional distance to deal with these people in her space, telling her horrible things.
Are we not Emperor? Are those not our citizens? How many?
At least 80, ma'am. Another 100 wounded, many critically.
And in the cathedral, how many dead?
2, ma'am. Nafa Dolg and a member of the guard. Another guard member is critically injured.
And who was responsible?
We don't know for sure. No one has come forward. Limbar nodded to Amit Nohama Peten. But Lord Nohama Peten has some information you may find relevant.
Cardinia turned to Amit, regarding him tiredly.
What is it, Lord Nohama Peten?
Your Majesty, as you may know, a few years ago my younger brother Grenny went to End to represent our interests there. In the time since, he has become a confidant and advisor to the Duke of End, who has been fending off a well-organized and well-funded rebellion. Your father and Parliament authorized further funding and equipping of the Duke and his forces, if not the direct, overt involvement of the Marines at End's Imperial Station. My brother wrote in his confidential reports that when news of that vote reached End, the rebels there vowed to retaliate.
You're saying this is the work of End rebels? Cardinia asked.
My brother's reports are, of course, delayed by a substantial amount of time, ma'am, Amit said. This is one of the problems with a far-flung empire. News is slow if it comes at all, but, yes, my brother was emphatic on the point that they were planning something.
When was this report from your brother?
We received it roughly 3 standard months ago, ma'am, which means he filed it 9 months earlier.
And you did not think to inform our father?
The House of Nohama Peten did not presume to trouble your father on the matter without further investigation, especially during his illness. We have confidential reports from all our system representatives, which outline all sorts of local unrest wherever our interests are. This proclamation was not in itself that noteworthy. Also, our analysts presumed that any retaliation would be focused on Imperial interests on End, not here. You may be assured that Grenny, my brother, would have informed local Imperial authorities so they could take precautions. In retrospect, of course, we should have shared the information further. I apologize, ma'am.
No one thought they would have this far a reach, Archbishop Corbine said.
You represent the executive committee here, Cardinia said to her. Tell us what their thinking is.
Their thinking is livid, Corbine said. An attempted assassination on the day of your coronation. The damage at one of the church's holiest places. And scores murdered in a cowardly attack on innocents. The committee is ready to support you, whatever you decide to do, ma'am. As will the guilds, the parliament, and, I most strenuously assure you, the church.
We all stand ready, Amit said.
Cardinia nodded.
We thank you.
She turned to Limbar.
Your thoughts on this end theory?
We need to investigate further, but the information Lord Nohama Peton has already shared with us is compelling. We're looking for any end nationals here on Xian and Hub and digging into their histories to see what comes up. If there's a connection here, we will find it.
Find it soon, Cardinia said.
Yes, ma'am.
What will you do now, ma'am? Corbine asked. This is an indelicate question, but many thousands are still here, waiting to hear how you want to proceed with respect to your coronation. The rest of the Hub system is also anxious to know. It's already been a day.
How long were the coronation celebrations going to last?
5 days, ma'am, Geldang said.
We're in a period of mourning for 5 days, then, Cardinia said. From the moment of the coronation forward. See to it that the victims are honored.
She turned to Corbine.
You will hold a service for them tonight in the cathedral.
Corbine nodded.
At the end of the mourning period, we will address the entire system and the interdependency.
The Parliament will not want to wait to address this, Corbine said.
We did not suggest work or investigation stop during this period.
Yes, ma'am.
In the interim, publicly at least, we will be in seclusion.
She nodded to Deng.
Gel here will be your point of contact for the next several days.
She looked back at Corbine.
We trust the executive committee will not protest handling administrative issues a short while longer.
No, of course not.
I will send updated reports when I have them, and be available if you have questions, Limbar said.
We thank you,
Cardinia said, and rose.
Everyone else rose with her, taking the hint they were dismissed. Only Deng remained sitting. He knew he was still needed.
Your Majesty, a private word, if I may.
Amit Nohama Peton said, as the others exited.
Yes, Lord Nohama Peton, Cardinia said.
She was still standing and did not offer to have him sit, and she assumed that he would take the hint that any word he wanted to have would be brief.
Amit picked up the hint, and his eyes flicked to Deng, still seated, registering that the word would not be all that private either.
He approached Cardinia instead, stopping at a still respectful distance, and spoke in low tones.
I wanted to personally convey my condolences to you in this moment of loss, he said. I know you and Nafa Dorg were close. It is hard to lose anyone we love, as my own sister learned with the loss of your brother.
Oh, nice, Cardinia thought. Even in attempting to express a moment of condolence, Amit Nohama Peton couldn't help but remind her that his family still considered the position of the Emperor's spouse their own property. She looked at him and saw the unremarkable face, an unremarkable body, and behind both, the reportedly unremarkable mind happiest in the pursuit of unremarkable pleasures. The sister and the younger brother were apparently the brains of the Nohama Peton outfit. This one was a lump. His appearance in this meeting was obviously an attempt to ingratiate him toward Cardinia by offering up useful information, followed by the humanizing moment that was happening right now. All delightfully scripted for her consumption. Cardinia thought about the prospect of being married to, and having children with, this lump, and barely suppressed an impolite shudder.
We thank you, Lord Nohama Peton, and are gratified for your concern.
If Amit picked up on the fact that Cardinia was still using the imperial address, he didn't let it stop him.
I hope, after an appropriate time, that we can meet again in happier and friendlier circumstances.
It is to be hoped, Cardinia said. Those circumstances being you no less than 30 meters away, she thought.
Amit, however, was not a mind reader,
and chose to interpret the carefully ambiguous words in a manner that was positive toward him, which was exactly how Cardenia had planned it, as much as she hated the necessity of it at the moment. He smiled, bowed, and exited. Cardenia waited until he was out of the room before she sagged a bit.
"Are you all right, ma'am?" Deng asked.
"No," Cardenia said. "My friend is dead, and this creep is still trying to arrange a marriage with me." She stopped suddenly and turned to Deng.
"I apologize, Gel," she said. "I didn't mean to speak like that. I'm used to Nafa being here, and speaking freely to her when we're alone."
The old secretary smiled at his emperor.
"Your Majesty, I was loyal to and silent for your father for nearly 40 years. It's in the nature of the position. I would not presume to be in the place of your dear friend. But I promise you that you may always speak freely near me if you choose. My loyalty is to you now."
"You don't even know me," Cardenia said.
"With respect, ma'am, I disagree. I've known you for years. First through your father and his peculiar but fond relationship with you. And for the last year, I've seen enough of you to get a sense of you. If I know nothing else, ma'am, I know that you are worth being loyal to."
Cardenia's eyes suddenly welled up. "That's one of you, at least. That's a start."
"What may I do for you now?" Deng asked.
"Can you bring back Nafa?"
"No, ma'am."
Cardenia jerked a thumb back in the direction of Nohama Peton. "Can you tell this creep to take a hike?"
"If you wish it, ma'am."
"But you don't advise it."
"I don't consider it my place to give advice to emperors, ma'am."
"I need someone to give me advice right now. I don't have anyone else."
"Rather than my own advice, let me tell you what your father thought of the Nohama Petons, to help you make your own decisions," Deng said. "I'm sure he wouldn't mind me telling you now."
"Please."
"He thought their ambition was admirable. He didn't consider them particularly wise, however. He thought that, left unchecked, they would eventually cause him as emperor to, as he called it, make a mess to get them back into line. Which is why he eventually manipulated the Nohama Petons into suggesting that Nadashe Nohama Peton should marry your brother. He believed that, as a couple, their ambitions were in accord, and that then the Nohama Petons would have a reason to act with less stupidity. That was his word, not mine."
"So you think my father would want me to marry Amit Nohama Peton, to keep them in line?" Deng looked slightly pained.
"What?" Cardenia asked. "This will not be kind," Deng said.
"Say it anyway."
"Your father believed the marriage of your brother and Nadashe would work because they were complementary to each other. Complementary with an E, not I. He didn't believe you and Amit were complementary. He considered you passive and Amit unintelligent. And the marriage of the two of you would leave Nadashe, who is the power of her generation of Nohama Petons, unfulfilled in terms of ambition. And that would spell trouble for you, and for the throne."
"Maybe he would have preferred I marry Nadashe," Cardenia said.
"Oh no," Deng said. "She would have rolled right over you."
Or so your father believed," he added quickly.
"My father didn't think much of me."
"On the contrary, he thought very well of you, ma'am.
He just wished your brother had lived to be emperor."
"Well, Gel, so do I. But he didn't. So, here we are."
"Yes, ma'am. And what are the emperor's wishes?"
"When is Nafa's funeral?"
"It is 2 days from now."
"I will attend."
Deng looked pained again.
"What is it?"
"I have a note from a Dolg family representative, ma'am. It arrived earlier, and I've waited to speak to you about it. The family notes that your presence at the funeral would be a disruption, because the security around you would be immense, especially now. Also, Nafa's parents are Republicans, as will be many of the people at the service, and your presence might provoke some of those friends to do or say something improper.
They don't want me to start a riot."
"That's the gist of it, I'm afraid."
I want to talk to her parents then.
The letter also suggests that you wait on that, too. My understanding is that the parents have said they don't blame you. But there's a difference between not blaming you and being reminded their daughter is dead because she worked for you. It would be difficult for them right now.
Cardinia hitched in her breath at that and sat silently with it for a few moments.
I'm sorry, ma'am, Deng said eventually.
Cardinia waved him off. At the very least, I don't want them to pay for anything.
Her parents?
Deng asked.
Cardinia nodded. You mean regarding funeral expenses?
I mean for anything, ever again. Their daughter's dead. She was my friend. If I can't do anything else right now, at least I can do this, yes?
You are the Emperor, Deng said. This is something you may do.
Then do it, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Deng stood.
Will there be anything else?
Cardinia shook her head. Deng bowed, collected his materials, and moved to leave. Where will you be? Cardinia asked.
In case I need you?
Deng turned and smiled.
I am always nearby, ma'am. All you have to do is call.
Thank you, Gel.
Ma'am?
He left. Cardinia waited until he was well out of the room before she had a good, long cry. Maybe the seventh or eighth she'd had since Nafa's death. Then she remembered where she last saw Nafa and what Nafa had said to her. Not in real life, but in her dream. Cardinia looked over to the door to the memory room, sat there for a couple of minutes thinking, then got up and let herself into it. Ji appeared the moment she entered.
Hello, Emperor Greyland II. How are you?
I am alone, Cardinia said, and immediately hated the adolescent drama of the statement. But it was true, and there it was.
You are always alone in the memory room,
Ji said.
And, in another sense, you are never alone in it.
Did you think that up yourself?
I do not think,
Ji said.
It was programmed into me years ago.
Why?
Because, eventually, every emperor tells me they are alone.
Every emperor?
Yes.
That weirdly makes me feel better.
That is a frequent reaction.
The prophet is in here, yes? Raquella the First?
Yes.
I would like to speak to her, please. Ji nodded and shimmered out, replaced by a woman. She was small, and in this image, nondescriptively middle-aged, which was different from the usual depictions of the prophet, which showed her young and with flowing hair and striking cheekbones. The image did not look anything like this. It also did not look anything like Nafa. Cardinia felt a momentary spasm of disappointment about this, then inwardly chastised herself for it. There was no reason she should have expected the prophet to be Nafa outside of her dream. You are Raquella the First, Cardinia asked the image.
I am.
The founder of the Interdependency and the Interdependent Church.
Basically.
Basically?
It's a little more complicated than that, in both cases. But we decided that having me be the founder of both would serve the mythology the best, so that's what we said.
Were you an actual prophet?
Yes.
So you knew the things you were saying about the interdependency and the principles of interdependency would come true?
No, of course not.
But you just said you were a prophet.
Anyone can be a prophet. You just have to say that what you're talking about is a reflection of God, or of the gods, or of some divine spirit, however you want to put it. Whether those things come true isn't one way or another about it.
But what you said did come true. You preached for interdependency, and it happened.
Yes, it was good for me that it turned out that way.
So you didn't know they would?
I already told you that I didn't. But we certainly worked hard to make them happen, and to give it the appearance of inevitability. And of course, the whole mystical angle helped, too.
Cardinia furrowed her brow. You're a founder of a church.
Yes.
But listening to you, you don't seem to be particularly religious.
Not really, no.
or to believe in God, or gods?
I really don't. And when we designed the church, we intentionally made the divine aspect of it as ambiguous as possible. People don't mind having the mystical aspect of a church being poorly defined as long as you make the rules of the church clear. We did that. We modeled a bit off of Confucianism, which, strictly speaking, wasn't a religion, and added bits we thought would be useful from other religions.
So you don't believe in your own church?
Of course I do, Raquel said. We created a set of moral precepts to bind the various human systems together. We did it because we thought it was desirable and, to some extent, necessary. Since I believe in those precepts, I believe in the mission of the church. At least, the mission of the church when we founded it. Human institutions tend to drift from their creator's intent over time, another reason to have clear rules. But the divine element is fake. We decided that it was no more fake than the divine aspect of any other religion, as far as the evidence goes, in any event. Cardinia felt a little lightheaded. It was one thing to believe the predominant church of the interdependency was bunk, which was a thing Cardinia had believed for as long as she could remember thinking about it. It was inconvenient when, strictly speaking, you were now head of that church, but she could at least keep that to herself. It was another thing to have the founder of the church, or at least the core of memories that comprised her, confirm it was bunk.
Nafa was right, Cardinia said. The interdependency is a scam.
I don't know who Nafa is, Raquel the First said. She was a friend of mine, Cardinia said. I had a dream where she appeared to me, as you, telling me the interdependency was a scam. If I were telling this story, I would have said that I had had a mystical vision of the prophet, Raquel the First said. It was just a dream. In our line of business, there is no such thing. Emperors never just dream. They have visions. That's what we do. Or what we were supposed to do when I became the first emperor.
Well, I had the thing, and it wasn't a vision. It was a dream.
It was a dream that made you think. A dream that caused you to search for wisdom. A dream that made you consult me, the prophet. Sounds like a vision to me.
Cardinia gawked at Raquel the First. You're unbelievable.
I worked in marketing, Raquel the First said, before I was a prophet. After, too, but we didn't call it that after that point.
I'm having a hard time believing what you're telling me.
Raquel the First nodded. That's not unusual. Sooner or later, every emperor activates me to have a conversation like this. Most of them respond like you do.
Most of them? What about the others?
They feel happy they guessed it correctly.
How do you feel about that?
I don't feel anything about it. I'm not alive. Strictly speaking, I'm not here.
You're always alone in the memory room, and never alone in the memory room.
Raquel the First nodded again. I said that, or something close enough to it anyway.
Is the interdependency a scam? Cardinia asked directly.
The answer to that is complicated.
Give me the short version.
The short version is yes, but.
The slightly longer version is no, and.
Which version would you like?
Cardinia stared at Raquel the First for a moment. Then she went to the bench in the memory room and sat.
Tell me everything, she said.
Chapter 10. I have an itch, Mars Claremont said to his sister.
Where?
Vrenna asked. My entire head, Mars replied. As required, Mars had shaved his entire head short of eyebrows and eyelashes and had been fitted with cultivated hair and beard, each embedded in an epidermis-thin substrate of actual skin, which had been secured to his own with the use of a glue made from, or so the person applying it to his face told him, real human collagens. Next came the thumb pad, which made Mars feel like he had tape on his hand, against which he had to mightily fight the urge to pick it off. Then the contacts, which changed his eye color and iris pattern, and which included holographic fake corneas that would give the illusion of depth to the fake retinal pattern. I can barely see out of these contacts either. It's not a bad eye color for you, though,
Vrenna observed. Maybe keep those in after you get on the ship. You're funny.
The two of them were waiting on the elevator that would take Mars down to the lobby. The newly hired crew, for the Yes Sir, were told to collect there in order for their papers to be processed, and then to be bussed to port to head to the ship. That was convenient for Mars, who could blend in with the rest of the new crew. But it also meant that these were literally the last moments he would spend with his sister, possibly in his entire life.
"Tell Dad I'm sorry I didn't get to say goodbye," he said to Vrenna.
"I will. He'll understand. He won't be happy, but he'll understand. He'll be okay."
"And how about you? Are you going to be okay?"
Vrenna smiled. "I'm pretty good at being okay. If nothing else, I'm good at keeping busy.
And the thing is, rumor has it that no matter what, everyone on End is going to be really busy soon. I have an agenda, anyway."
"What's on the agenda?"
"The first thing is to dangle Granny Nohama Peaton off a building for kidnapping my brother."
Mars laughed at this, and then the elevator bell dinged and the door opened. Vrenna grabbed her brother in a fierce hug, gave him a peck on the cheek, and then pushed him, gently, into the elevator.
"Go on," she said. "Go tell the Emperor everything. Save everyone, if you can. And then come back."
"I'll try."
"Love you, Mars,"
Vrenna said, as the door started to close.
"Love you, Vrenna,"
Mars said, just before it did.
Mars had 20 floors to get his emotions in check.
The elevator opened up to a couple dozen people milling about, and three people in official House of Lagos crew uniforms. One of them looked over to Mars as the elevator opened up.
"What the hell are you doing in the elevator?" she asked.
"I was looking for a bathroom," Mars said.
"Well, there's not one in there. Get out of that."
Mars got out. The crew member held out her hand for his papers. He handed them over.
"Christian Jansen," she said, looking at them.
"That's me.
Any relation to Knud Jansen?"
"I don't think so.
I shipped with him once. He was from N2.
There's a lot of Jansens."
The crew member nodded and then held up her tablet.
"Thumb."
Mars pressed his fake thumb on the tablet, which scanned the print on it. The crew member then held up the tablet close to Mars's eyes.
"Don't blink."
The camera on the back of the tablet scanned Mars's contacts.
"Well, you really are Christian Jansen, and you don't have any outstanding warrants or debts, your guild union dues are paid up, and your personnel ratings are good,"
the crew member said.
"Welcome aboard."
"Thank you,
Ndan. Petty Officer Gitan Ndan."
"Thank you, ma'am."
"You're welcome, crewman."
Ndan looked at Mars's rucksack.
"You're traveling light."
"My other bag got boosted."
Ndan nodded.
"Sucks. When you get squared away, go to the quartermaster and get a new kit. You'll be charged extortionate rates, but that's your problem. You got marks?"
"A few."
"If you're short, come find me. I can lend."
"That's very kind."
"No, it's not. It's business. My interest rates are also extortionate."
Ndan pointed out of the lobby to a bus waiting outside.
"Get on that. We leave in about 5 minutes. Do you still need a head?"
It took a second for it to register that Ndan was talking about a bathroom.
"I'm fine." "Off you go, then."
She turned to see who else she needed to process.
It took 5 seconds for Mars to get from the lobby door to the bus, and he felt exposed the entire way. But he managed to get on the bus without incident, find a seat, and wait. He looked up through the window at the House of Lagos building and wondered if Vrenna was looking down. He felt briefly sorry for Granny Nohama Peaton, whom Vrenna was likely to thump the crap out of sometime soon. Then, in the distance, there was a brief thump that sounded like a shell hitting a building, and Mars remembered there were other things Vrenna and their father might still have to worry about first. From the bus to the port he went, through another paper check and thumb scan at Imperial Customs, then up the beanstalk, which was disappointing to Mars because there were no windows, and the video screen in the cramped passenger cabin showed nothing but informational customs videos and ads. At a certain point in the trip up the beanstalk, Mars was aware that his fake hair felt like it was being pressed down onto his scalp. He mentioned this to his seatmate, who nodded but didn't look up from whatever he was reading on his tablet.
"Pushfield," he said, then went back to his reading. Mars nodded to himself. Push fields were humanity's best approximation for artificial gravity, in which objects were pushed on from above, whatever above was in any particular scenario, rather than pulled on from below, as gravity was generally understood to work. The physics of push fields were discovered accidentally. Researchers back on Earth had tried to work out the problem of shaping a small bubble of local space-time around a starship in order to take advantage of the then newly discovered flow, and ended up taking a lot of side detours in the math. Most of these detours offered nothing of any benefit, but one of them did, and it was pressing on Mars's hair. Mars looked up and found the push field generator tubes, running down the length of the passenger compartment like fluorescent lighting. He, of course, understood the physics of the push field, since it was a consonant subset of the flow physics. But he'd never been off-end. He'd never experienced one. As he was experiencing it now, he found it slightly unsettling. He didn't like what basically felt like a giant hand pressing down on his head and shoulders, and he didn't like how it made his fake hair lay on his scalp. He looked around the compartment and noted there was a reason why most of the experienced crew kept their hair either very short or in tightly wrapped braids and queues. From the Beanstalk now to Imperial Station, which featured a rotating ring section for the Marines and Imperial staff who stayed at the station long-term, and a separate merchant section managed by push fields, where visiting ships unloaded and managed their cargo. Mars and the other crew got out in the merchant area, and he immediately understood why long-term residents would prefer to live in the ring. The push fields here, set to a standard G, were almost intolerably pushy. As Mars and the rest of the crew were led to the crew muster area for the yes, sir, he saw a collection of people in the cargo hold waiting. Those would be the yes, sir's passengers, he knew, with whom he would have been if Granny Nohama Peaton hadn't kidnapped him and marked him. The passengers certainly didn't look like refugees. They looked like what they were, wealthy people. They were milling with their children and their stacks of cargo at 1,000 marks a kilo as if they were about to have an adventure, rather than flee a planet forever. Despite the fact that he fully intended to be one of them, Mars managed to feel resentment toward them, toward the people who could in fact leave their problems behind through the simple application of money. "Well, you're a hypocrite," his brain told him. Well, maybe he was. But then again, he wasn't leaving to escape. He was leaving because someone needed to tell the Emperor and then explain to the Parliament and everyone else how the end was coming. That person just happened to be Mars. "Nope, still a hypocrite," his brain said. Then they were out of the cargo area and into a tunnel, funneling them toward the muster area and a shuttle. A final check of papers and thumbprint, and the shuttle detached from Imperial Station to the Yes Sir. Again, there were no windows. Windows were a positive hazard in the blank vacuum of space. But this time Mars could access a camera feed from his tablet. He did so, and saw the Yes Sir hone into view, a long tube with two rotating rings, an ungainly but strangely beautiful object. His home for the next 9 months.
"What a fucking hole," his seatmate said, looking at Mars's tablet screen.
"I think it's beautiful," Mars said.
"Looks pretty from a distance, but I've friends who've crewed Lagos ships before. They all have problems. House of Lagos is cheap. They run their ships until they fall apart and only repair them when the alternative is exploding. They scare me. And yet you're here about to crew a Lagos ship." "I was going to crew on the Tell Me Another one, but it's been impounded. Captain let pirates take her cargo, I heard. Switched over, last minute ad. Worth it. Things are going to hell on end."
"The rebels."
The man nodded. "That and the other thing. About the flow streams."
"What?" Mars said. He set down the tablet and gave his full attention to his seatmate.
"A friend of mine who crews on the Tell Me, the one who was getting me the gig on it, said they dropped out of the goddamn flow stream halfway here and only barely made back in before they were stranded forever. He's got another friend who told him this wasn't the first time. Flow streams are getting spotty all over the goddamn place. It's only a matter of time before the shit really drops. I sure as hell don't want to be on end when it does. I'm from Kiala Kakua. I'm going home." This is the first I've heard about this, Marsh said. You haven't shipped in the last few years, then.